Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have had the pleasure of knowing and working closely with Brian Kennedy in a number of phases of that war and have come over the course of many years to admire him greatly as a man of letters, a serious thinker about the challenges that we're facing, and a very active contributor to, well, the war of ideas, I guess, is the best way to describe it. These days, he is the president of an entity called the American Strategy Group, as well as a senior fellow and board member of the Claremont Institute. He served as the president of that distinguished institution from 2001 to 2014. Among the other places where you can find Brian Kennedy's writings is in the Claremont Review of Books, fittingly enough, but also in National Review, Investor's Business Daily, The Wall Street Journal, and myriad other publications of note. It is always a delight to have him with us, and I couldn't be more pleased to say he is agreed graciously to give us a full hour of his time today to talk about things on his mind and that should be on ours. And I know you're going to enjoy this, as will I. Brian Kennedy, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Well, thank you, Frank, and thank you for that very generous intro. As I often say when I talk to you, I am the biggest Frank Gaffney fan in the world, and whatever strategic thinking I may possess is derivative in a large extent to all your wisdom over the years. So great to be with you today.
We will stipulate at the outset that we have a mutual admiration society. Now, let us talk, speaking of some of your areas of expertise and interest. You have just recently written a piece in Real Clear Politics about the political war being waged against Donald Trump. I want to talk to you about various aspects of that. But Brian, for many of us who, if we think about national security at all, we generally think of it in terms of kinetic kinds of warfare. We here have made a point of trying to speak as well about economic warfare and occasionally information warfare and the like. But help us think about the domain of warfare that you've described as political war.
Well, it really is a form of war as we know it, isn't it? I mean, there's, as you say, there's kinetic war where people are actually shooting at one another, and those things do matter. But when we have adversaries, they would always like to win without going to war.
Especially to the extent that we're more powerful than they.
Right. And so they know in a free society like ours, whatever enemies, foreign and domestic, we may have, that we're susceptible to political manipulation because we live in a free society. There's the news on TV and now on the internet. And how people acquire that information is so varied these days that if you can get a meme, as it were, and put it out there, it can have a life of its own, and that influences our political decision-making. The Chinese, I think, referred to it at one point as memetic subversion, meaning once you can establish that meme, as in Trump is a traitor, if you can say it often enough, then don't be surprised if enough of our fellow citizens as political actors may believe that. They may not like Trump, but once these political ideas get out there and manipulated, then they get manipulated. And it's not easy enough just to tell the truth. You have to tell the truth if you're on our side who believes in freedom, but you also have to dispel those lies, and they take on a political quality all its own. It's not merely disinformation, but it's a form of political manipulation that most people just don't appreciate, they absorb it, and then they're influenced by it. I think much of what you're seeing in the media today is that just being played out.
But you know, Brian, there's a lot of talk about, you know, influence and interfering with our elections, mostly in the context of Russia. We're going to talk at length in the course of this hour about your thoughts on Russia, but for the moment, to confine it to just this question of the political warfare being waged against Donald Trump, when you speak of that, when you've written about it in Real Clear Politics, is it about what the Russians have done, or is it a source of political warfare perhaps aligned with the Russians, but not coming from them directly?
Yeah, no, that's a good clarification. I really mean this, though, in the sense of whether we call it the Democratic Party or the American left or those parts of the American left that are in the intelligence community. They're the ones that seem to be engaging in this political warfare. Look at John Brennan. John Brennan is an ex-CIA director who certainly sees himself as a man of the left. He goes on TV, and he's not doing it, I hope, at the behest of the Russians, but he certainly is willing to say that the president is a traitor when he knows for a fact all the information that his agencies have gathered related to that would suggest that the president is not merely not a traitor, but a patriot. And Brennan goes out there in the media and says these awful things about the president. Now, how can you understand that as anything? It's not simple partisanship. He means to establish in the mind of an American, we'll call them a liberal or a leftist, whatever you want to term it, he wants to establish a hatred of Donald Trump. Not merely a dislike, but a hatred. When you call someone a traitor, that would suggest that the man should be arrested, put in jail, tried for treason, convicted, and put to death. That's a radically different thing than a political disagreement. And so when I talk about political warfare, I mean the intelligence community or the narrow operatives we're describing here, they're making war against the president. How else to understand it?
Yeah, and when you look at John Brennan, and he's a very interesting exemplar of this problem, not by any means the only practitioner of it, but John Brennan was a partisan political operative for a period of his career. To be sure, he was also in the Central Intelligence Agency and rose through the ranks to be the chief of station, that is to say, the top CIA operative in Saudi Arabia. But there was a hiatus there after he left that position, and he went to work for Barack Obama as an advisor on his political campaign, was rewarded when that campaign was successful by the elevation to the role of Homeland Security advisor to the president, in the course of which he played a very partisan political role, too, I would argue, notably with respect to the Muslim Brotherhood. And then he was moved over to the CIA in the second Obama term. And I think everybody who's familiar with the agency recognizes that he did huge damage to it in politicizing it. And turning it into, in fact, an instrument of political warfare domestically against Donald Trump as candidate and then as president-elect. Brian, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, we'll talk more about the nature of the attack on Trump as it relates specifically to his ability to perform the functions of the commander-in-chief. That and more with Brian Kennedy. We'll be right back.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I am thrilled to say, joined for this full hour by my friend and colleague Brian Kennedy, now with the American Strategy Group, a longtime president of the Claremont Institute, and the author of a very important piece recently in Real Clear Politics entitled The Political War Against President Trump. And Brian, I wanted to draw you out before we start turning to some of the foreign policy and national security challenges that are, I believe, made more challenging for President Trump and for our country, for that matter, by the endless assault on him from, well, shall we say, enemies domestic as well as foreign. I wanted to speak of with you in the former category, the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is a group that, as most of our listeners know, I'm sure, has taken it upon itself to be the arbiter of who is a hater in our country. They have directed that label at me repeatedly, and interestingly enough, had to settle a lawsuit for some $3.375 million with somebody else they disparaged recently at the Quilliam Foundation, demonstrating both by their apology and by their payout that they falsely accuse people of hatred and hate-mongering and the like, and they do material harm to those individuals when they do it. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this, Brian, because as I see it, the Southern Poverty Law Center these days is nothing more than an instrument of political warfare, and that they've set themselves up as an arbiter is bad enough, but that they're being regarded as such by journalists, by social media platforms, by corporate sponsors and the like. Talk a little bit about the implications of that for the freedom of speech, for example, and more generally, the security of our polity as it is under attack by such organizations and those who make common cause with them.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very important thing, Frank. When you look at places like the Southern Poverty Law Center, you do see agents of influence operating here in America. Now, are they agents of a foreign government, or are they simply radical leftists who have taken it upon themselves to engage in this political warfare? But what you see is a kind of disintegration in American society, where what we used to think of as honest journalism or impartial journalism doesn't exist anymore. And that partly stems out of the fact that the modern university doesn't really care much about the truth. They care more about moral relativism, and they don't care about pursuing what the meaning of life or the meaning of freedom really is all about. So once you destroy in a free society like ours an understanding of the truth, then the rest of society can be manipulated. And whether it's journalism or social media or Facebook or Twitter, these kind of institutions can be manipulated by the Southern Poverty Law Center and other leftist groups, and they establish an idea and they force other people to refute it. But when they repeat it often enough and major newspapers carry it and treat them as authentic, either because they're complicit or ignorant of what the Southern Poverty Law Center really stands for, you see a breakdown in civil discourse. So all of a sudden, Frank Gaffney's called a racist because he believes in defending the United States. Now, anybody objectively, any citizen objectively, can look at what you're saying and realize that calling you a racist is complete and utter nonsense. Hence, you won that court case. But look at all the trouble that happens in the meantime, right? You have to defend yourself. And if in the public mind they can establish that you and other freedom fighters are racist, then $3.375 or whatever million dollars that was is a small price to pay. If they can discredit you, who are such a powerful voice, if they can discredit you, that's a small price to pay. And so we've entered an age where there really is very little honest journalism, what Trump calls, you know, fake news nowadays. There's so much fake news that people become confused about what the truth is. And so they have to rely on their common sense, which is quite often difficult because they don't know the facts.
Yeah, that's the point I really wanted to get at, is that if you don't have the facts, if you can't get access to information that is deemed inappropriate or hate-mongering or whatever else one wants to call it, then common sense can't really operate in an informed way. And you at the Claremont Institute, particularly, Brian, over the years, did so much to cultivate in so many, not just the readers of the Claremont Review of Books, but your Publius Fellows and the like, an appreciation of the genius of the founders and our constitutional republic's grounding in so many important precepts. But one of the most important of them, it always seemed to me, was that for this to work, this idea of a democratic form of governance, a republic, that is, you had to have an informed electorate. So when the Southern Poverty Law Center or when its fellow influence operators in the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, or its amplifiers in the media, fake news most especially, and on, operate to silence those of us with whom they simply disagree politically, it actually has a ripple effect, does it not, through the electorate and more broadly, the American people, because they're simply being denied information they need to know to make informed decisions about, well, you know, the policy direction of our country or those who would formulate it.
Yes, I think everything you just said is exactly right. And once people don't know the facts, then they become confused and they become dispirited and then maybe they even become disinterested, right? And so so once leftist groups can establish these ideas out there, you know, long enough and hard enough, then the people become very confused about what the future ought to look like. And you're right, it does undercut, you know, the basis of a free society. Now, to be sure, there's always going to be politics. People are always going to be arguing. But when there's so little regard for the truth and dishonest messages can propagate so freely, especially on social media platforms, then the basis of a free society is, I won't say called into question. It's just going to be much more difficult. And conservatives have to be much more actively engaged in trying to spread truthful messages, or otherwise known as the truth, about what it takes to defend this country. And so the left is always animated to engage in political warfare. And they'll always have these groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and others. You know, back during the Cold War, the Russians sponsored a lot of these, you know, different front groups. Today, it's still the Russians and the Chinese sponsoring various front groups or encouraging them, getting them going just enough to where they take off all by themselves or influence the message just enough. And all that in a free society, again, is very dangerous, which is why you want an American intelligence community that is on the side of freedom. When you had a John Brennan and the Obama administration, they were on the side of a global vision of America, much different than the American founders. And they were more than willing to spread out, you know, various lies.
How would you characterize that vision on the part of those on, I mean, it's one thing to simply say they're leftists, but what are the central tenets of a John Brennan, again, as an example, that are so much at odds with, obviously, both the Trump presidency and the founders of the republic as well?
Well, you know, that's an excellent point. It's not enough, is it, just to call them leftists? Well, people like you and me, Frank, look at the world and we see, or look at America, and we see it as a beacon of freedom and hope for not only Americans, but for the whole world. A guy like John Brennan, a product of the modern university, you know, the modern schools of international relations and the like, they look at America and they see a problem. They see capitalism, which they think is evil. They see a bunch of white men who they think are racist. They think we have built this super wealthy country, and so therefore we must be selfish. And we once had slavery in our past, so therefore we must be racist and evil. You add those together, a guy like John Brennan thinks, my job is not to spread the American ideal, but to check America wherever I can. Do not let America become powerful and dominant in the world because America's bad. A guy like Barack Obama went around the world apologizing for America's past. If you think America's past is bad, that our struggle to perfect our freedom is a bad thing, and then you apologize about it, well, your external policies are going to be, in the sense that we understand it, are going to be anti-American. Your internal policies are going to be anti-American. These people have been formed by the idea that America is the problem because of what we stand for. You know, a guy like Brennan looks at the Islamic world and thinks there's virtue there. He'll think these may be an oppressed people. They have grievances. America is a bad country, and therefore those grievances must be real. He sees how serious the Islamic world is. And so his sympathies run to them because in this globalist worldview, the pan-Arab movement is one of the groups that ought to be supported. Yeah, to the average American, this will seem like nonsense. But to someone who has been shaped by globalism and the modern university and its leftist tendencies, this just makes perfect sense. And that's part of the problem of our ruling elite today.
It is indeed. When we come back, we're going to talk about the ruling elite a little bit. An announcement today that Jim Jordan is going to run for Speaker of the House. Potential shakeup in the swamp, the firmament of the establishment, and of course, the elite more broadly. That and much more we'll discuss with Brian Kennedy right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Brian Kennedy is in the house virtually for this full hour. I hope you found interesting what he's been saying about political warfare that is being waged in our country and some of the forces that are operating that really hope to take down not just President Trump, but I'm afraid our country as well. And a man who has stood athwart that for many years in the House of Representatives has just today announced his preparedness to serve as the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the next Congress, or preferably much sooner if possible. His name, of course, is Jim Jordan. He is a member of the House of Representatives from Ohio, founding member and initial chairman of an outstanding group, the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives, and a man that I must say I would be thrilled to see serve in the Speaker's office. Brian, your thoughts about this announcement and what it might mean for the elites and others that are really bringing us such grief, whether they're, frankly, of the left or, for that matter, of the establishment right.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's great to bring this up because Jim Jordan is just a fabulous individual and a fabulous congressman, and exactly the kind of leader the Republicans and the Congress needs, in part because he sees that this political war is going on. He understands the nature of political warfare. He understands that it's a struggle between sort of establishment, big government progressivism, and what is genuinely freedom and limited constitutional government. And that's what he's been pushing on. And I think one reason there's such a fight is because there are too few people like Jordan who understand that it really is a contest between those people who believe in freedom and those people who believe in big government. And, you know, I think it would be just great if he were Speaker, and I totally agree, sooner rather than later.
Indeed. One of the things that the next Speaker of the House, as well as the President, of course, is going to be confronting, Brian Kennedy, is the challenge that we are facing from those enemies foreign. We talked a little bit about Russia in the context of the alleged influence operations against our country. I'd like to get your sort of broader perspective, especially in the context of the summit that took place two weeks ago now in Helsinki with President Trump and Vladimir Putin. Where is Russia at the moment, as you see it? Where is it headed? And how much of a problem does it represent, as you see it, for our security interests? And consequently, what should we be doing with response to it?
Yeah, I think Russia is still a very important adversary. They're an enemy of the free world, and they possibly are an enemy of the United States, but hopefully not one that's going to be an enemy forever. And I know we'll get into China, but Russia is a country that is still trying to figure out where it ought to align itself. The Chinese are the big power. They have a lot of people. And there's an old saying that quantity has a quality all its own. Now, when Trump looks at the world, he first sees China and then he sees Russia. This outreach to Russia, I think, in part has been, can you win Russia for all their bad behavior, for all their bad past? Can you win them over to the side of the West to be a check against China? Or is Russia simply going to make their bed, as they have been, with the Chinese? If it's the latter, then they're going to be an intractable enemy for the foreseeable future. If they can see a way of aligning with the West, and I think they'd only align with the West if they thought we were the winning side, if we're going to be the winning side, they might join us. They might, but they might not. Trump wanted to go visit with Putin, not to relay that exact message, but to express the idea that we're back. We're rebuilding our military. We're rebuilding our Navy. We're building a national missile defense. We're going to have not just energy independence, but energy dominance. And then with the building of a national missile defense and a space force, if he's actually able to do that, the Russians then have a choice. They can side with the Chinese as our enemy, or they could maybe be our friends. And we'll just have to find out. But I think Trump wanted in that effort to show him he was serious. He was serious about America becoming the strongest nation in the world. I think that's the only thing he wanted to achieve, and to show that we respect Russia, not as a friend, but as an enemy, but an enemy that could hopefully be won over to our side. And in that regard, if we can actually get there on that, and that will not be through diplomacy, but through the rebuilding of both America, the American economy, and the American military, if we can do that, we can persuade the Russians, or the Russians will be persuaded all by themselves, that we're the winning side. And if we fail in that regard, then there'll be a problem.
You know, Brian, as you're saying that, it harkens up the old Soviet era line about the correlation of forces. And I think what you've just described is an eminently sensible approach to this. I'd rather see more of the improvements in place sooner that you've just described that are part and parcel of President Trump's policies. And by the way, you know, it was heartening to hear Mike Pompeo yesterday say in his testimony on Capitol Hill, our Secretary of State, that the policies are governing, not whatever was the takeaway from the press conference or Vladimir Putin's comments, most especially afterwards at the summit. And also, Brian, that we're seeing a postponement of further summitry with Vladimir Putin until this business with Bob Mueller, again, political warfare, it seems to me, is brought to an end. This is the sort of thing that we'll be watching very closely, as I know will you, and we are going to continue to welcome you back to help us understand what to make of it. I do want to turn to China, though, Brian. You have been very, very clear-eyed about the threat posed by the Chinese, the fact that they are, as a practical matter, at war with us, that they seek, as the CIA analyst recently noted, to displace us as the dominant power in the world. Walk us through the implications of that, if you would. And again, I'm interested in your thoughts about what we best be doing about it as well.
Well, I think the Chinese really are the great threat. And they're the great threat because the things that used to motivate the United States and the Soviet Union were, again, a certain balance of power or correlation of forces, however you want to describe it. With the Chinese, they may not be motivated by stability. With the Soviets, we wanted stability. During the Cold War, Reagan wanted to win the Cold War, but he wanted to do it without actually going to war. We don't really know what the Chinese think about all those things. But to the extent that we do know, they talk in that famous book from 1992 by Chinese generals, they talk about unrestricted warfare. And so they wanted the United States to know that they think of us as an enemy, and that they are prepared to do anything, a combination of political warfare, economic warfare, cyber warfare, terrorism, real warfare, they describe. they are willing to do whatever it takes to become the most powerful country on earth, period. And they will do whatever in their power to achieve that. They're very patient. They don't have to do it overnight. They're building an economy which is almost the size of ours. They're building a navy which will be bigger than ours. It may not be as good as ours, but why will the Chinese not want to make one better than ours over time? And over time, they will want to make one that's better. And as they become richer, they'll be able to afford it. One defect we Americans have is that we project onto other people what we see in each other. You know, Americans see free people who go to work every day and they raise a family, and they don't want to conquer the world. They simply want to have a nice life. They want to go to church on Sunday and enjoy the things that a free people enjoy. Americans know Chinese people in this country that do the exact same thing as they do. And they like them because they're Americans. They project that same idea onto people in other countries. And those people in other countries, on the other hand, they have a different worldview than the Chinese person they will meet here in the United States. Those people in China today, President Xi is a very ruthless man who's willing to do every bad thing that Vladimir Putin is willing to do in his own country. China sees itself as the preeminent power in the world. Whether they can achieve that today or not is a different matter. With Trump, he sees what they've been saying and what they've been doing, and he understands that that's where the great conflict is in the future.
My assessment, Brian, on this very point is that increasingly it seems clear that the unifying field theory of Donald Trump's presidency, at least with respect to international affairs, seems increasingly to be countering China, and that most, if not all, of the various steps that he's taking vis-a-vis Putin, vis-a-vis the allies, vis-a-vis his actions in the Far East, especially North Korea even, this is basically about China. And the Trump doctrine, if you will, has that as its central focus. I'll be interested in your thoughts on that. On the other side of a short break, we'll be right back with more in our final segment with Brian Kennedy, former president of the Claremont Institute, now with the American Strategy Group. Stay tuned.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Brian Kennedy is with us. I'm pleased to say for the remainder of this full hour, I have always valued his insights, but never more than at the moment, when there is so much that needs thoughtful analysis and commentary. He provides it routinely, among other places, at Real Clear Politics. How do they follow you at American Strategy Group, Brian? Is there a website there?
Yes, so brian@amstrategy.org.
There we go. Brian Kennedy, let me ask you about a couple of other things that are relevant to what we've just been discussing in terms of the challenges of our time and that correlation of forces. You have been a champion for many years of missile defense and have understood that the kinds of threats that existed in the past needed to be countered, among other things, by comprehensive defenses, not minimalist ones that might be able to handle what the North Koreans or the Iranians perhaps could lob our way, but even that of the Russian arsenal or the Chinese, for that matter. When you look at what President Trump is doing with respect to missile defense and now increasingly the emphasis that he's placing on a space force, do you think that's what's coming? And is it, in fact, what's especially needed as we look at some of the developments of things like hypersonic and maneuvering missile technologies against which our present missile defenses are simply inadequate.
Yes, I do think, Frank, that Trump does see missile defense as central to what it takes to defend the country. Because so long as Russia and China and these other nations have ballistic missiles that can destroy us, then if you don't have a defense, you can be subject to nuclear blackmail. And just because we haven't had nuclear war up to now doesn't mean that one is possible in the future or impossible in the future. That when you look at the ability to use nuclear weapons to manipulate an American president, that's very powerful. Now, I would say about Trump, he has talked about a space force. That is great. He's been serious about missile defense, and that is great. But there's a window of opportunity to get this right. And he only has, at best, 6.5 more years. He has to, with breakneck speed, deploy the most effective missile defense possible as soon as possible while perfecting a broader, more effective layered missile defense. Getting to space is a very high priority because it's the strategic high ground. That's why he announced that Space Force. But if you look at Iranian doctrine or North Korean doctrine or Chinese or Russian, the first thing they want to do is attack us with an EMP weapon and destroy America's electric power grid.
Now, that's, of course, an electromagnetic pulse attack.
Right. If they can launch one of their nuclear weapons in the high atmosphere, one, we may not even know who launched it, if they launched it from a ship. But if our power grid goes down, and I know you've talked about this on this show many times, but if that power grid goes down, America goes down. And not for a day or a week or a month, but permanently. We will either die or lose our sovereignty to the Chinese and the Russians.
Or for that matter, it could be the North Koreans or the Iranians or some other party that understands this vulnerability. And Brian, you've written extensively on this, I know, a number of times in the Wall Street Journal. The Trump administration has professed a keen interest in enhancing our infrastructure, making significant investments in that. Do you believe that they're taking seriously this threat of what can only be called our Achilles heel, the vulnerability of our most critical of critical infrastructures?
Well, I think they do take it seriously, but again, it's back to that window of opportunity or vulnerability. The president only has so long, and his administration has to match his ambition. He's ambitious to get that done, but the Washington swamp is very slow to move. Bureaucracy is very slow to move. I think the president has only learned that over the course of the last year and a half. I think he thought it was probably easier to move than it would be, but he has to up the game of his administration if we're going to get this done during his tenure. And if we lose, if the country has a shift politically in November and the Democrats take control of either house, then you're going to see the kind of gridlock that will slow down any ambition Trump has to do these things. Because some of these things, like hardening the grid or building missile defense, these require appropriations. And this is why a guy like Jim Jordan is important.
Yeah, it strikes me as peculiar in the extreme that this isn't understood to be the ultimate transpartisan issue, the vulnerability of our grid, because if it goes down, as you say, if somebody deliberately takes it down, and maybe it's via electromagnetic pulse, maybe it's cyber attacks, maybe it's physical sabotage, or maybe it's nobody attacking it at all. It's just the massive solar storm for which, as you know, we are overdue. But whatever the cause, people will die, as you say, and it won't be on the basis of their partisan leanings or political philosophy. We are all going to go down, so all of us ought to be pulling together. And you've done yeoman work in elevating this issue, Brian, and I just want to say that the refusal of the bureaucracy to move in the manner that the president believes is needed, in this area especially, which is only reinforced by the attitude of utilities that mostly, amazingly enough, is that nothing needs to be done about all this. despite the fact that their equities are on the line, both those of their customers and they own most of the grid, as you know. This is sort of mind-boggling. And again, all I can do is urge you to keep up the pressure that you so effectively bring to bear, Brian, to make sure that the public is informed about this and demanding corrective action, which is both needed and overdue. Let me turn to one last item with you, Brian. You're, of course, based in California, a state that has arguably been most impacted of any in the union by illegal immigration. And both in your time representing the Claremont Institute in Sacramento and, of course, as president of the Claremont Institute and currently with the American Strategy Group, you are, I know, seized with what is happening to California politically as well as demographically as a result of illegal immigration. And I just would invite you to talk a little bit about what's going on in your state and whether it serves as a cautionary tale for the rest of the country about the implications of open borders for both our economic well-being, our security, homeland and national, and not least our sovereignty.
Yeah, well, I think illegal immigration is one of the most important issues, because if you undercut people's understanding of what it means to be a citizen, you've effectively undercut the meaning of America. The great flaw in our immigration debate, it seems to me, emerged from, of all places, New York, and their outlying political influence in the country, especially when it comes to economics. I mean, everybody knows an immigrant. Most people have been immigrants, or their families have at one time or another. Americans look at immigrants and they love them. They like them, they're their neighbors, so let's just get that out of the way. The problem today is with open borders, you have a whole generation, you have millions and millions of people who live amongst us who start out not respecting the law, meaning we have a legal immigration system, they flaunt it, they go right through. So they start out not respecting the country. I mentioned New York. They used to be a great vehicle for assimilation. You became a New Yorker from whatever country you came from, and you just became an American. It was a great melting pot. Today, in places like California, there's no melting pot. So that generations of immigrants come in, they keep their language, they keep their culture, and they don't really become Americans in the sense that they understand what freedom and limited government's all about. And once the number of people like this gets to a certain point who neither respect our laws nor understand the country itself, you transform the society. California has been transformed politically by this. And you have large numbers of people who go through an educational system that doesn't do a very good job of teaching anything, doesn't teach American history. And if it does, it teaches very often that America is a bad place, that same globalist view I was talking about earlier. When you combine a bad educational system with a huge number of illegal immigrants, don't be surprised if politically you become transformed into something else.
Brian Kennedy, we are hard out of time, I'm sorry to say. In the meantime, I'm so grateful to you for both the exemplary work you have done for so long. Thank you for taking the time today to go through these issues with us with some care. I hope you come back soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.